areas of Britain, the winds will be gale or severe gale force for a time. On Saturday, looks like we'll see sunshine and blustery showers and feeling on the cool side before the next spell of wet and windy weather sweeps in off the Atlantic for Sunday.
All right, staff, thanks a lot. Well, now we continue with our book of the week, Gold by Matthew Hart. By the end of the 19th century, most industrial nations were on the gold standard, a system in which paper money is convertible to gold. But in the upheavals of the 20th century, country after country withdrew from the system, leaving the United States and Richard Nixon to finally sound its death knell.
In July of 1944, only weeks after D-Day, the representatives of 44 countries arrived at a meeting at the town of Bretton Woods in the New Hampshire forest. Within days, 730 delegates were rewriting the rules of international finance. There was no question of a return to the old gold standard system because the United States had 75% of the world's monetary gold. At Bretton Woods, the participants agreed instead to peg their currencies to the US dollar, and the dollar would be convertible to gold. In the first post-war years, because the dollar was what everybody wanted, dollar convertibility was essentially a technicality. This changed with crushing speed. In a span of only 13 years, the combined effect of international largesse and foreign war, a global military establishment and trade deficits, drained the treasury of the United States of half its gold. At a point when the United States owed $60 billion and its gold stock was $12 billion, a French economist pointed out that asking America to pay its debts in gold was pointless. "It's like telling a bald man to comb his hair," he said. "It isn't there." When Richard Nixon came to office, money was pouring out of the country to pay for the Vietnam War and for the import of foreign goods that Americans increasingly preferred to their own, such as Japanese and German cars and electronics. Yet the main problem in the minds of American voters was the inflation that was driving prices higher. That was the problem Nixon had promised to solve. At the same time, the administration had to face the other, potentially humiliating problem: what to do about the mountain of US banknotes piling up in central banks around the world, each one of them an IOU for American gold. For foreign governments, that was the pressing issue of the day. They knew they could not all show up at once to cash in dollars because the gold demand would empty Fort Knox. The prospect of such an ignominy would probably cause the United States to head it off by closing the gold window and refusing to convert. Moreover, the dollar anchored the global financial system. A run on the dollar would mean chaos everywhere. For these reasons, the foreign governments held off. The tension grew. Anyone with large dollar holdings would necessarily worry about other countries with equally large dollar holdings. What if someone broke the tacit agreement keeping back the rush? What if one country reached a secret accord with Washington and surreptitiously unloaded dollars while everyone else sat on theirs? The solution to the American dilemma seems simple. Do just what the foreign dollar holders feared. Shut the window. Let the dollar float and find its value against other currencies according to what the market thought it was worth. But ending gold convertibility and letting the dollar float presented problems too. The dollar would drop in value. A lower dollar would mean that the imported products that Americans craved would be more expensive. It would look as if the administration had abandoned the struggle against inflation. Nixon would have failed in his pledge. The president would take the blame. In Washington, attention fixed on the Treasury. The secretary was a player whose appointment had raised eyebrows, a Democrat in a Republican administration. He was Nixon's antithesis, a bold, smooth-talking, swashbuckling lawyer who towered above the physically unimpressive president. He had been Secretary of the Navy and Governor of Texas. His portrait at the Treasury shows a man at the summit of his powers, sitting against a desk in a yellow room flooded with light, a commanding, confident, silver-haired man in a pinstripe suit with one fist resting on his hip. This was John B. Connolly. Connolly had been in President John F. Kennedy's cabinet and had a particularly vivid association with the Kennedy mystique. As governor of Texas at the time, he had been riding in the open presidential limousine when Kennedy was shot and had taken the same bullet that killed Kennedy. The bullet that struck the president passed through him and hit Connolly in the back. The bullet made Connolly a minor martyr, a role he was to exploit to such an extent that 4 years after the assassination, the Baltimore Sun and other newspapers suggested with editorial sarcasm that the black arm sling that Governor Connolly is so fond of wearing is getting frayed. Connolly was the perfect partner for Nixon. The president wanted an audacious solution to the crisis. Connolly did not care what that solution was. He brought no policy of his own to the Treasury. His talent was a knack for selling whatever policy the president might choose. "I can play it round or I can play it flat," he liked to say. "Just tell me how to play it." The measures Connolly and Nixon contemplated were political dynamite. They used the gold crisis to push the plunger. In the spring of 1971, as overseas dollar deposits kept growing and the tension increased in foreign capitals, whose central banks had more dollars than they wanted, Nixon and Connolly made their decision. If any foreign dollar holder appeared at the gold window to convert, the Americans would close it. From that moment, the dollar would cease to be convertible. At the same time, and most importantly from the point of view of the American voter, the government would impose wage and price controls. The policies would be linked and sold to the public as a structural intervention on behalf of ordinary Americans, protecting them from both the crushing burden of rising prices and the predatory practices of foreign speculators. They would sell this so boldly, Nixon believed, that it would demolish the slightest chance of opponents saying he had not gone far enough. Crucial to the success of the two-step plan was secrecy. If word leaked out, merchants and manufacturers would rush to raise prices in advance of controls. Foreign dollar owners would stampede the gold window. Instead of a decisive forward-looking strike, the plan would crumble into a rearguard action fought to prevent the rout of a beleaguered economy. To preclude a leak, Nixon admitted only two of his most trusted advisers to the plan that he and Connolly had formed. For months, only four people in the innermost circle of the White House knew that the United States planned to annihilate the system underpinning the world's finances. All Nixon needed was a pretext. As the summer of 1971 went by, Americans focused on rising prices and the rest of the world on the American dollar. In August, in a week of heavy dollar selling that pushed the value of the currency ever lower, The Guardian reported that whispers about the dollar's uncertain future have now turned into open forecasts of devaluation. There is not enough gold now in Fort Knox to meet more than a fraction of the total possible claims which could be made by foreign holders of dollars. For Connolly and Nixon, the time to cut the country free from its golden shackles had arrived. They were just waiting for the right moment to pull the trigger. That moment arrived when an envoy from the Bank of England came to the Treasury and asked for the redemption of $3 billion into gold. Nixon had planned exactly what to do. On Thursday, August the 12th, Connolly cut short a Texas vacation and rushed back to Washington. The next day, the president and his advisers helicoptered to Camp David to write the script that would topple gold from its place in the monetary system. Gold's final days as money had arrived. Those who flew the 60 miles north to the presidential retreat on Maryland's Catoctin Mountain knew that they were making history. At the first meeting of the weekend, Nixon reminded everyone of the importance of secrecy. They were forbidden even to tell their wives where they were. Word of the top-level meeting at Camp David leaked out and heaped more logs onto the fire of speculation crackling through foreign capitals. The Observer quoted the U.S. Treasury as stating, "We are dedicated to preserving the integrity of the dollar, we are not going to devalue it or change the price of gold. Our position on this is unwavering. This was strictly true. They were not going to devalue the dollar or change the gold price. They were going to unhook them. Most of the Camp David planners were exhilarated by the weekend, but Nixon fretted about timing. On the brink of dismantling the global financial system, he worried about interrupting the hit TV Western, Bonanza. Millions of Americans sat glued to their televisions every Sunday night, addicted to the fictional Cartwright family whose adventures played out on the Ponderosa Ranch. Nixon was not the only president to respect the devotion of Bonanza viewers. President Lyndon Johnson had made it policy never to let the affairs of state disrupt proceedings at the Ponderosa. But Nixon's advisers convinced him that he had to speak before the markets opened on Monday morning. Ready for their moment, even exhilarated, the presidential party returned to the Capitol, and that night, on television, the president made the announcement that rippled out through an astonished world and was known ever after as the Nixon Shock.
In the past 7 years, there's been an average of one international monetary crisis every year. Now, who gains from these crises? Not the working man, not the investor, not the real producers of wealth. The gainers are the international money speculators. Because they thrive on crises, they help to create them. In recent weeks, the speculators have been waging an all-out war on the American dollar. The strength of a nation's currency is based on the strength of that nation's economy. And the American economy is by far the strongest in the world. Accordingly, I have directed the Secretary of the Treasury to take the action necessary to defend the dollar against the speculators. I have directed Secretary Connally to suspend temporarily the convertibility of the dollar into gold or other reserve assets, except in amounts and conditions determined to be in the interest of monetary stability and in the best interest of the United States.
The first market with a chance to react was Tokyo, opening for business as the president's words flew across the Pacific and detonated on the trading floor. In a single hour, Japan's commercial banks unloaded $300 million in U.S. cash. At the same time, Japanese investors started dumping the stock of companies with big American export markets, for Nixon had done much more than slash the mooring line between the dollar and gold. He had announced a package that included an import duty on foreign manufacturers. As dismay spread around the globe, the White House awaited the American response. They needn't have worried. It was jubilant. And why not? Prices would stop rising. The tax on imports was sugar-coated by the cancellation of a federal tax on buying an American car. Money straight into the voters' pockets. And good for the country, too. When the TV lights clicked off in the Oval Office at the end of the address, the United States dollar had changed from a drawing right on gold to a paper note whose value would thereafter be a matter of opinion. But what had gold become? Gold metamorphosed. Its shape changed in the human mind. No longer hard currency, or even its relation, gold became the phantom money of the imagination. Shadow money.
Gold was written by Matthew Hart, abridged by Pete Nichols and read by Robert Glenister. The producer was Karen Rose, and it's a Sweet Talk production for BBC Radio 4. BBC Radio 4. Now the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 today, Thursday the 23rd of January. There are warnings of gales in Viking, North Utsira, South Utsira, Forties, Fisher, German Bight, Irish Sea, Shannon, Rockall, Malin, Hebrides, Bailey, Fair Isle, Faroes and South East Iceland. The general synopsis at 1800. High near Azores, 1,035, slow moving, intensifying 1,039 by 1800 Thursday. New low, expected Faroes, 987 by the same time. The area forecast for the next 24 hours, Viking, North Utsira, South Utsira, northeast 40s. Southeasterly 7 to severe gale 9, occasionally storm 10, except in northeast 40s. Rain or snow, moderate, occasionally very poor.